Were you guys moved by the museum today? I think all of us were probably, we were walking around. Yeah, well, anyway, give them a hand. And I think if we could go around the room, what was your favorite part? We would be here for another 3 hours, so we're not going to do that. So we'll just tell you what my favorite part was. And I was moved literally. I went down and did the Washington Revelations. Did anybody do? Let me see your hand. So you are moved almost to throwing up. I don't know if any of you felt that, but I was glad I was in the back because I was turning green. But you're flying through and you're on this thing and you're moving, and I'm just glad they had wind blowing. At one point there's mist, because that just grounded me a little bit longer. But I felt like you're flying through Washington, going through the Capitol, and it's amazing what they do, and they're showing you all the scriptures that are hidden around D.C. that now I'm worried that now everyone's going to get that film, and they're going to start sandblasting just parts of just the way we're living right now, right? But I felt like I was in a Christian version of National Treasure, and I was Nick Cage, and I was seeing all the secret things embedded throughout D.C., it was fantastic. And just looking through, I know we were talking about some of the neat things. I didn't get to see this, but did any of you see the microchip or like the postage stamp Bible that you have the whole Bible on this really small microscopic, it looked like a little postage stamp or whatever, that they took on the moon. And they left it there on the moon, and I don't think that'll be in First Man, but that would be cool. It should be. So it was great. And you think about what it took to put this together. They did not just slap this together overnight. It took a lot of money, it took a lot of resources, it took a lot of ingenuity, and we have a special treat tonight. We get to interview one of the guys, one of the key people to help put this together and put the content together that all the stuff that you saw, he's had a hand in, he and his team from Polymath. So Dr. Tim Dalrymple, where is he? Right there, looking at his emails. That's great. Thanks for listening, Tim. Starting off really well. We're going to bring these. These actually were made down in Nazareth by that carpenter. He had been working on these today. You can find them at any Hobby Lobby, anywhere. So are you coming? You're coming up here, right? Okay. So Tim Dalrymple has become a great friend, and we have gotten to know him.
Maybe
it's one-sided. It's good to know where we stand. We had a little DTR right now. I feel good about that. But I got to know Tim because we were started going down the road of renovating the WTR to do a renovation. One of my heartbeats was I really wanted to have somebody that had not drunk the Family Life Kool-Aid, that had not been through the history, would come in and give some perspective, give a third eye to what we're, because we love it. And it's almost like if you've been living in a house that you've loved for the past 40 years, you have a reason for why your walls are the way they are, or why you hang certain pictures, or why you do. But and when somebody comes in that has never lived in your house, they ask the good questions like, well, why did you put the wall here? And if you did this and you just opened it up a little bit, have you ever been through a renovation? And to have somebody from the outside to come in, we knew, though, that if somebody was coming in from the outside, we had to be really careful because we love the message of Family Life and what God has done through it. So we knew it was going to be a stewardship of some very precious jewels. We wanted to be theologically aligned, somebody that had a great pedigree and was aligned theologically from the first start. And so I started talking to different people, and a friend of mine, Bill Miller from Dallas Seminary, I heard that he was a part of a group called Polymath, working with Dr. Dalrymple. And so he put me in contact with Tim, and we brought Tim and Joyce, his wife, out to Charleston, South Carolina.
That's right.
And we were able to do a weekend to remember there, and I found out that Tim has degrees from Stanford, studied at Oxford, Princeton, and Harvard. Or as I like to say, my backup schools if I didn't make it into Liberty. That's kind of where... That was where I was thinking about going if God hadn't called me into ministry.
If only we could all reach so high.
All right. Yeah. That's right.
I was also in a boy band when I was young, like Justin. Yeah. But unlike Justin, I could dance.
Yeah. You don't throw that out there.
I have a rider against that sort of thing.
Okay. So, Tim, tell us a little bit about you and Polymath and what you do with Polymath. Because First of all, polymath. It's hard enough just having math. Now you have polymath. What is polymath?
Way too many maths.
That's a lot of math.
Basically. Yeah, so polymath is a full-service creative agency, partly because of my academic background and the academic backgrounds of some of the team members. We've been very involved in content development. Mm-hmm. So multimedia content that needs to have a certain degree of theological sophistication, be informed from a scholarly perspective. And so we began to work with the Museum of the Bible a long time ago, back when it was really just Steve Green and a handful of people. Mm-hmm. And one of the original visions was to develop a Bible curriculum. Mm-hmm. So people know about the museum here, but there's also what's called the core version of the curriculum that was developed and is presently deployed in various places around the world and in the U.S. in private schools and in homeschools. And then there's a second version. That first version, it wasn't going so well. They brought us in originally to revise and rewrite it. Mm-hmm. The second version is really kind of laser-targeted for public schools in the United States, designed to be something that would be educational, informative, but also appropriate in our kind of constitutional setting. Mm-hmm. So we wrote that, and then we began to work on things that were here inside the museum as well.
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, I definitely want to introduce your better half and family. So tell us a little bit about it was just you for a second there. Tell us a little bit about them. I know you like to talk about yourself, but let's go on to the family.
Sure. So that's my wife, Joyce, up there, and my elder daughter is Sophia. The middle one is Sarah. And then Hannah, whom we just brought back from China a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. So my wife is, she was originally a journalist, and then an attorney, and now she's working in ministry. And our children are already working for my company. So mm-hmm. That's good. I'll be able to hand it over to them someday.
That's right. We got to consult the child labor laws, but that's great that you've got got them on board. You know, before you started Polymath, your trajectory was very different. I mean, you were going to be headed in Stanford. You were on pace to be on the Olympic team back in 96, right, with gymnastics?
Yeah, yeah.
And that God intervened. In what way?
So I was a competitive gymnast when I was younger and won the national championships a few times. Mm-hmm. And I was competing for Stanford my sophomore year, when I fell from the high bar and broke my neck. And that was the end of my gymnastics career. But I know it sounds like a sad story, I suppose. But I really should have been a quadriplegic for the rest of my life. It was high enough to break that I would not have been able to breathe. And so one of the very first things that the doctor told me, a completely secular doctor, is that it is a miracle that you're still able to move and feel in your body. Mm-hmm. And so I experienced the presence and the faithfulness of God in that hospital room in a way that I never really had before. Mm. And that was when I was able to devote my time toward other things and ministry and academia. And the original vision was to be a winsome Christian presence within the secular university.
Right.
God had other things in store that have been even better than that.
Yeah. But God's plans for us are often greater than our dreams. And true in your case. And I'm really glad that, I'm not glad that you fell from the high bar, but I'm glad that you've seen that perspective and have shifted. And just thinking about, you know, Stanford, Oxford, Princeton, Harvard, to still come out with strong evangelical moorings, what has been for you that thing that has kept you grounded?
You know, honestly, it's been the example of my dad. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I was always a skeptic, always a questioner. But I could not doubt the fact that there was something. There was a grace and wisdom and self-sacrifice in my father's life that I found extremely compelling. So there was a truth that infused his life that I, at the end of the day, couldn't deny.
Yeah.
So it speaks to the power of families, the power of good parenting, and so forth.
Yeah. And you also have a Crew background. You were with Crew, have done stints with Crew.
Yep,
and
yep, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
To East Asia.
That's right. Yeah. Just trying to win you over to the Steve Sellers of the world in here and ingratiate yourself to him.
That's right. I was briefly on Crew staff mm-hmm. when it was still called Crusade, but... Yeah, I stayed for an extra quarter at Stanford, and during that time, I was technically on staff with Campus Crusade.
You know, we started talking about Museum of the Bible, and I found out that you were part of this. It was great when we were getting the Weekend to Remember planning and dreaming about that, and I started hearing about just how the tension that you felt in creating content that you knew would need to appeal to the faithful, but yet the challenge was, how do we communicate that in such a way that anybody coming in could see the Bible just as literature, or would be able to not feel like they're getting in a sense, proselytized, even though the gospel is clear throughout this whole building.
Yeah, I would hope so. And yet, you know, a lot of folks come here and they do wonder, why isn't there more Jesus? And that is one of the reasons, that it was really designed to be as inviting as possible with a very broad audience. All of the Jewish friends that are friends of the museum, all the Jewish scholars who were involved, secular scholars as well. It was very important that this be a place that that serves a purpose of inviting all people to engage the Bible. Mm. Trusting that if we can make them fascinated with the Bible, they go home, they engage with it, and then it's up to the Spirit to do its work. Mm.
So tell us a little bit about kind of what, as far as you think about even interpreting this building for us, like what you hope people walk away with.
Yeah, well, I was really glad that we did the top 10 tour, mm-hmm. and he took us through the, I guess there was a woman as well, so he and she, the tour guides, took us through the history floor, some of the major exhibits there, and the impact floor. And one of the things that was really impressed upon me over the course of my time working with the museum was just that the story of the kingdom of God and its spread around the globe is really the story of men and women of faith who inherit a timeless truth, but use all of their energy and creativity and diligence to communicate that timeless truth in ever new ways, mm-hmm. for new generations, in new places. Mm-hmm. So they go beyond,
yes.
Point of term.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeking ways to go beyond the comfortable ways that they inherited of communicating that word, because the needs are always changing around them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Take us through some of those ideas and thoughts of just how you've seen that transmission and technology really marrying together.
Yeah, can I stand up or would that make you nervous?
No, No.
Are you intimidated?
I am, a little.
Right. Yeah.
Do you want me, am I in the way? Can you guys see okay? I'm going to stand over here then, make sure they can see those slides.
All right, sure. Well, you may have seen something downstairs that looked like that. This is a cuneiform tablet, and kind of in the early biblical period, in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament period. Then this is before those texts were written down, but in the time in which a lot of those stories took place, this was the way of communicating. And we tend to think of technologies as electronic things, right? The computer in my backpack is a technology. But there was a time when the backpack itself was the technology, and the pencil inside of the backpack was a technology. People needed to invent those things. They needed to develop those. They needed to better understand the natural world. And so technology is the development of new tools and techniques for manipulating the world around us. And this is where communications technologies really started. So this is cuneiform. Why is everything wedge-shaped? Because that's all that they could do in a rock or a clay tablet with a knife. So they're using a knife to cut literally these wedge shapes. But as time goes on, you get beyond this. This isn't very easy to transport. It's not going to carry that much information. You get into things like wax tablets, which don't write very well and certainly don't last very well. This is very durable, which is why we have examples of this. Excuse me. But you get very quickly, obviously, into things like scrolls, right? And papyrus. But then papyrus, they all came from Egypt, and the guy in Egypt didn't want to give it away. So this new thing called parchment rose up, and parchment became better at the ways in which it captures the ink, and better versions of parchment were created. And eventually you move from the scroll. The scroll is also difficult to transport. And if you're trying to cross-reference things, it's just a nightmare. So eventually they have the codex or codices, and new ways of putting all of that information together carries you through kind of the early Christian period and into the Middle Ages. And eventually you have these codices that have spread around Europe, not very many of them because they're extremely hard to produce, they don't travel very well, but nobody can read. So how do you train people in the biblical stories and the biblical message? Well, one way you do that is through art. Stained glass windows were one of the great ways of educating people about biblical stories. Eventually you get to paintings and you get to things like this. Illuminated manuscripts. This is the Book of Kells, which is not here, but you saw some great examples of illuminated books, illuminated Bibles downstairs. So these communicate the gospel story in new ways. Eventually you get to better kinds of ink and better kinds of, you know, paper comes over from China, and you have better ways of writing things. They begin to divide things up into columns and number the chapters and the verses. And you have something called the Paris Pocket Bible, which is the first time that these were produced at a fair amount of scale, fairly quickly by students in Paris. And it was small enough that you could transport it very easily. So suddenly, the Bible begins to go mobile. Beyond that, of course, you know, you're familiar enough with the Gutenberg press. I probably don't need to say a whole lot about that. But it took a long time, actually, to make a Gutenberg Bible. It took still a couple of years. But in that time, you weren't making one. You were making hundreds, about 400 or so in the first printing. So at that scale, much cheaper, much more sustainable, all the way to today, right? Where you have something like the YouVersion Bible app, which is in so many different languages all around the world, all of this speaking to creative ways of leveraging technologies as they're developing. Another example that we could give is even in, you guys saw the New Testament story, I hope you enjoyed that video, but even then the spread of the gospel around the Mediterranean and into other places was dependent on new technologies in shipbuilding and navigation. So you start off with something like this, you eventually get as navigation improves, eventually you're developing, you know, technologies of flight. And so this is Betty Green Mission Aviation Fellowship that allows people to take the gospel to new places that were unreachable before. Another example that's more proximate to us is new media technologies, mass media technologies. So revivalists like Billy Sunday, Dwight Moody, and Amy Semple McPherson are leveraging radio in the 19th, early 20th century to communicate at a different kind of scale, right? Did anybody see The Crown? Has anybody watched that series? Well, in the second season, you see the Queen watching Billy Graham on television, right? That's how millions of people were introduced to Billy Graham. Would his ministry have been possible without that kind of technology? I don't know. There were probably a lot of people, as television was coming out, who viewed it with a certain degree of skepticism. But Billy Graham saw an opportunity, and so he leveraged this new emerging technology to reach people at a scale that was just unbelievable. His ministry would have been profoundly different if he had not had access to that. Then you have things, you know, beyond television, beyond the black and white sort of image, you have films like this that are utilizing the most powerful storytelling technologies available today. Now, what would that be in our time? We'll talk about that in a sec. But the point that I want to make here is that men and women of faith have sought for centuries to innovate and adapt, to deliver the Bible in ways that are fresh and effective for new generations while maintaining fidelity to God's word. So this has been fun for me to, in this process, you'll just notice the technology that's used in the New Testament theater and in the Hebrew Bible walkthrough, which is my personal favorite part. Right, you see technology leveraged in this space to tell the biblical story in a very, very different way. This immersive experience that you have there. And there's one kind of theological point that I want to make here, that when we go out into the mountains and see the beauty of God's creation, we are moved in our souls to magnify God, right? When we stand in front of a laptop, we don't necessarily feel that way, right? But there was a time... and this is in the Greek Fathers period, when they had a very different theory of technology. And they, you know, Jesus was a tecton. He was a builder. He was a craftsman. And they preached to a lot of tech. This is where the word technology comes from. They preached to a lot of those kinds of craftsmen. And they were talking about how, you know, if the mountains glorify God, how much more does it glorify God that he created human beings who have the creativity and the will and the intellect to fashion things, new technologies, like that computer, that can be used in these ways. So it's illuminated for me the many different ways in which technology can glorify God and serve the good, which I think you saw today at the museum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tim. You know, that's one reason why we're excited about partnering with them, and they've been helping us as we've been revamping WTR 2.0. We're going to share a little bit more about what are some of the changes and what are the things that are staying the same, and we feel that tension between we want to transmit in new ways, but yet we don't want to abandon the truth of God's word, and how do we make that timeless and still transmit at the same time. And we'll share more of that tomorrow. But thanks so much for being a part of that. And I know just for you personally, why has it been so exciting for you to be a part of helping us with Weekend to Remember?
Yeah, well, it has an extraordinary legacy. And so we did feel very much there. We're helping to steward timeless truths, but to hopefully communicate them in a way that equips family life to be successful for another 40 years. And I feel as though with, you know, I've gotten to know Brian really well and getting to know David more recently, but this new generation of leadership is really, really exciting to me. And the opportunity to build on the amazing things that have been done in the last four decades. But there are new generations that are so desperate for transformative experience, so desperate to find meaning in their own lives and ways of living together as families that are authentic and true. And it's definitely my hope that, and you'll be talking more about this, but that some of the ways in which we're recasting this are going to make it as transformative for the next generations as it has been for all of us.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Dr. Dalrymple. Give Tim a hand.